Welcome back. Tomorrow will mark 1 month since the attacks on Israel of October 7th, the terror attack launched by Hamas against Israeli civilians, killing over 1,400. The worst attack on Jews since the Holocaust. So that has led now to this conflict between Israel and Gaza. But one element of all of this that can't and shouldn't be overlooked is the hostages. Hamas murdered over 1,400 Israelis that day. But there were also a number of civilians, over 240, that were taken hostage. Now, Israel has insisted that there can be no ceasefire or pause without the release of the hostages. So far, though, that hasn't happened. And as this conflict continues, there is indeed growing concern about the fate of these hostages, which does include women and children. So their status does need to remain front and center. And families of these hostages are working to ensure that that remains the case, that we don't forget about them, that any conversation about where this all goes needs to ensure that their safety remains a top priority. So joining us to talk more about this is someone who is right in the midst of all of this. Aaron Brodetch is a Canadian Israeli living in Toronto. His sister-in-law, her three children, were all kidnapped from their home by Hamas on that fateful day and taken to Gaza, where they remain as hostages. They're obviously very concerned about all of them, the children especially, and want the Canadian government to make the release of the hostages a top priority for us as we engage on this whole situation. So as mentioned, joining us on the line here this afternoon from his home in Toronto, Aaron Brodetch on the line with us. Aaron, thank you so much for joining us through what's obviously a very difficult time for you and your family, but do appreciate making some time for us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Just first of all, what's the latest? Have you heard anything at all in recent days, or what do we know about the hostages and about your family members in particular?
We don't know very much. We know they're in Gaza. We believe they're alive. We have not been told otherwise. But apart from that, we know nothing.
What can you tell us about, your family members, your sister-in-law, her children, where they were living, and what happened to them on October 7th?
Yeah. So Hagal, my sister-in-law, and her three children, Ofri, who's 10 years old, Yuval, who's 8 years old, and Uya, who's 4 years old, together with another girl named Avigail, who's 4 years old, were taken into Gaza. My brother, he lives in Kibbutz Kfar Aza. His house is the first house on the fence. And when everything started, he heard a knock on his door, and he saw a girl, was the neighbor's girl, Avigail. She was covered in blood, what later turned out to be her father's blood. He was murdered probably on top of her. He took her in the house, gave her to his wife, and told them to all hide. He went out to help in the kibbutz. And somewhere during all the fire, he got hurt and couldn't make it back home. And meanwhile, he was texting with his wife, and he got the message, they're coming in. That was the last he heard from her. At that point, he believed they were all killed because Hamas was going door to door, killing everyone and burning the houses down. And so I was in Toronto at the time, and at that point we believed they're all dead for about a day and a half. But a day and a half later, someone told us that he had seen them taken into Gaza. And 3 days later, when they were able to clear the kibbutz, soldiers went into the house, and they saw that the house is empty. They reported this to my brother. When they told him this story, they actually said that his house was the only house that had water working. And so all the soldiers came in to drink. And when they opened the fridge, they saw birthday cake because his older daughter, Flea, had, was just about to celebrate a birthday party with her friends that Saturday. And so all the soldiers started crying immediately when they kind of realized what had gone on in the house.
Yeah, your niece, had, as I understand, just in fact visited you this past summer in Toronto.
That's right. So my niece, Ophelia, together with my mom, came to visit us in summer for a month. My niece went spent part of the time at summer camp, and so she made a ton of Canadian friends without even being able to speak English. She's an incredibly, incredibly fun child, and you know, it was just fun to be around.
And part of the reason you're speaking out is to make sure that these stories remain at the forefront, to make sure that this is a priority for the Canadian government as we address the situation. Do you feel like enough is being done right now to try to secure the release of the hostages?
No. It's been more than a month. When I left Canada to be with my family in Israel, I was completely expecting everything to be, not everything, but at least the hostage situation to be over within a few days. There are 240 hostages. Most of them are civilians. Many of them are children, 33 children. It makes absolutely no sense that it is taking this long. I think people's priorities are just wrong, you know, especially the Israeli government that has not prioritize this at the top of the list, which is crazy, but also other governments who are, you know, trying to look at the larger conflict. There is clearly a terrible conflict that's going on, but there's one piece of that conflict which is very obvious, and that is that a terrorist organization is committing an insane crime. You know, it's a human rights crime. It's a crime against humanity every single day by holding these hostages. This is not normal warfare. This is completely crazy.
Well, I know Israel has refused to accept any ceasefire that does not involve the release of the hostages. What's your sense of what it's going to take then to secure their release?
I don't understand how these things work, and I'm getting information from, you know, different people who have wildly different opinions. I have no idea how to judge them. But it certainly, you know, discourages me to hear the Israeli government saying that releasing the hostages is one of the objectives of the war. You know, clearly this is the most pressing objective. These hostages, every single day that passes, is an absolute nightmare for children who are staying there. You know, Yuval is 4 years old. He's, you know, we do not want him to celebrate birthday underground. This is, you know, there's a child there who's 10 months old. He was 9 months when he was abducted. He has spent 10% of his life in tunnel underground right now. You know, this is extremely time pressing. And, you know, clearly not whatever they're doing, it's not the right thing, because they're still not out.
You know, something we've seen here in Canada and in the United States as well, and it's really disturbing, where, you know, individuals have put out posters of the hostages to try to keep them at the forefront of all these conversations, raise awareness about this side of the story. To see those posters being torn down, I understand in Toronto police arrested someone today who was tearing down posters and actually assaulted somebody who was trying to stop them. I mean, it's hard to understand what would lead someone to do that. As you go through all of this, and I mean, it's your family, your loved ones who are in this situation, what goes through your mind when you see and hear about that?
These are either very stupid individuals who have no idea what they're doing, or extremely sick individuals who, you know, think that holding civilian hostages prisoner is some kind of normal piece of resistance. You know, Hamas is not resistance group. It is a terrorist organization that is violating every single international law. And this is holding women and children hostage.
Yeah.
Is nuts. And anyone who's tearing down the poster is clearly either very stupid or at least misinformed, or just a terrible, terrible human being.
We'll continue to follow this and hope they come home soon and safe. Aaron, all the best to you and your family. And again, thanks, sir, for speaking with us here today. Really appreciate this.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Yeah, so there you go. That's Aaron Brodach, Canadian-Israeli living in Toronto. His sister-in-law, her three young children remain hostages of Hamas almost 1 month after that horrific day.
Ask for a ceasefire. How can you ask for Israel to stop their aggression when you go on television in Lebanon here last week and say that you will continue your aggression? You will continue
you
to launch October 7th again.
What do you want us to do? To stop?
If you're asking for a ceasefire.
Well, that was interesting. That was Ghazi Hamad, who's the spokesperson for Hamas. And maybe you've seen him being interviewed by various international media outlets. That was an interview with NBC. And they asked him, well, you say you want a ceasefire, but you keep fighting. And the Hamas spokesman says, well, what do you want us to do? Stop. So it's pretty clear that, you know, when we're talking about a ceasefire, when people are calling for a ceasefire, they're basically just asking one side to stop fighting. They're just basically asking Israel to stop fighting. But that's not a ceasefire. When Hamas says that they're prepared to carry out their Al-Aqsa flood operation over and over again, we should take them at their word. When the spokesman for Hamas says, what would you want us to do, stop? It's pretty clear that they have no intention of stopping. Now, Israel's prime minister today is saying that, you know, it's a non-starter. The idea of a ceasefire is a non-starter unless Hamas is prepared to release hostages. And at this point, it doesn't appear as though Hamas is. So again, those who are calling for a ceasefire, are they also calling on Hamas to release the hostages they hold, in addition to stopping their attacks, stopping their rocket volleys aimed at Israel? So for now, the conflict continues. Israel stepping up its ground attack in Gaza to try to root out Hamas officials and especially Hamas infrastructure. And this network of tunnels that Hamas has built over the years, that's a particular interest to Israeli forces. By the way, there was a story from NBC yesterday. As UN officials say hospitals in Gaza are running dangerously low on fuel, Hamas is maintaining a stockpile of more than 200,000 gallons of fuel for the rockets it fires into Israel and the generators that provide clean air and electricity. So that's, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 750,000 liters of fuel. That's an enormous amount that could go to use, especially when that's been one of the concerns expressed that no fuel is getting into Gaza. There seems to be plenty of it there, but Hamas is using it to fuel the rockets they continue to fire into Israel, the same rockets they refuse to stop firing, even as they call for a ceasefire. So this is the reality of what we're dealing with here, the same group that carried out these atrocities on October 7th. And no doubt this conflict is causing great harm to civilians. Right? War is messy, and we know that, and we're seeing that. But what is the alternative here? What can be done with Hamas? What needs to be done? Can Hamas be defeated? Wouldn't that be a good thing for the region? It's a really interesting op-ed in the National Post today on the problem with Hamas and how for Muslims it should be viewed that if Hamas is defeated as a good thing, as a win for the Muslim world, that this group is destroying the reputation of Muslims while hiding behind innocent human shields, say the authors. Well, joining us on the line here this afternoon is the co-author of that op-ed. You can find it at nationalpost.com. Raheel Raza is president of Councils for Muslims Facing Tomorrow, also a board member with the Council of Muslims Against Anti-Semitism. Much more at her website, raheelraza.com. Raheel, so great to have you with us here today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Your thoughts on what we're seeing unfold right now. I mean, it is a deadly conflict, obviously, and we're seeing painful images emerge every day. But certainly, you know, what we saw on October 7th was quite shocking indeed. Just your thoughts, first of all, on where things are at here.
Well, what happened on October 7th was horrendous. And this was Hamas's horrific attack on Israel. And people soon forget that it was Hamas that started the attack. Now, you were just talking about speaking to a Hamas spokesperson about a ceasefire. And I just wanted to explain to you that if you have to understand the mindset of the jihadist, which is Hamas. I've been studying and opposing the jihadist mindset since even before 9/11. You know, I experienced the beginning of it while living in Pakistan, came to Canada. I didn't know how it would unfold, but 9/11 said it all. So in Gaza right now, it is the jihadist mindset of Hamas playing out. It has nothing to do with peace talks, to do with the Palestinian issue, or any kind of a ceasefire. And you would ask me why? Mm-hmm. Because it all boils down to hate and anti-Semitism. What is a jihadist mindset? It's the politics of hate. Right. They hate them because they're Jews, and for their own made-up reasons, they think it's their duty to kill all Jews and obliterate them from that land. So how on earth would they talk about any kind of a ceasefire?
Well, exactly. Let's talk about what Hamas is. And to elaborate on what you just said, I think there's maybe a tendency in the West to think of Hamas as some sort of a Palestinian resistance group or a Palestinian nationalist group. That's not what they are, is it?
They're definitely not. In fact, I don't believe they even care for the Palestinians. They are an Islamist terrorist organization with roots in radical Sunni jihadist movements, mainly the Muslim Brotherhood, and they are strongly supported by Iran and the Lebanese Shia proxy Hezbollah. Now, you know, the question that people need to ask, the masses need to ask, that they've had a free run of Gaza since 2005. But because of the jihadist mindset with a single purpose to kill all Jews and rid them of their land, they brought misery on their own people. You know, with the kind of financial aid that Hamas has been getting globally in billions, Gaza could have been another Singapore. They could have built infrastructure and schools and hospitals, but it's a shameful condition. And my heart goes out to the civilians because they are not at fault for what Hamas is doing. And the fact is that not all Palestinians even support Hamas because they have brought so much misery on their own people. And this is what people must realize. And if they think that they are doing this because of religion, I'm a practicing observant Muslim, and I can tell you that nothing that they are doing is even closely resembles what my Islam. So, you know, raping women, killing children, brutalizing the elderly, taking hostages, it's all against the basic rules of what the Quran, our holy book, tells us. Mm-hmm. Like even in war, you will never harm women, children, the infrastructure, and the environment. So who are they? They're jihadists.
How do we defeat them then? How is Hamas going to be defeated?
Well, the way that it is happening now, and it's very, very unfortunate that the collateral damage is with civilians, but that's because Hamas uses civilians as shields. You know, they operate from homes, they operate, they hide ammunition in schools, they base their fighters under hospitals, so it's so unfortunate that civilians get hurt. But this right now, for everyone globally, Hamas needs to be dealt with. And let me also explain something else about the jihadist mindset. They are not warm, fuzzy people who want to sit around a table and have peace talks. They walked away from so many opportunities for a peace deal. Unfortunately, because of their barbaric and savage mindset, the only way they understand is power. The only way they can be dealt with is more strength than they have. As I said, it's unfortunate that there are civilians that get caught up in this, but they do not understand any other language. It's very sad to say this, but that is who they are. You know, they are savage in their treatment of human beings. So they don't care who gets killed in this war. They just want to eliminate the Jewish state and the Jewish people.
That same Hamas spokesman was doing an interview, and I believe it was an Egyptian journalist, if I'm not mistaken, but a brave journalist, certainly, who asked the question that you Hamas have built hundreds of kilometers of tunnels underneath Gaza. You've not built a single shelter for citizens to hide in. Once, you know, you start this conflict, Hamas is the one starting these wars with Israel, and then there's nowhere for the citizens to hide, but there's all these miles of tunnels for Hamas fighters to use. And he said, well, those tunnels are for us, for Hamas, and said that, you know, the citizens are the responsibility of the United Nations. Like, Hamas isn't interested in governing Gaza or leading Gaza, protecting the citizens of Gaza, are they?
No, they're not. That is exactly what I said. If they had been, the situation wouldn't have been as bad as it is now for the civilians. They don't really care. They don't care who the collateral damage is, because their mind is so filled with hate for the other side that they don't really care who gets trampled in all of this. They're not about human rights. But, of course, when it serves them, they become the victims, and then they cry that they about colonialism and all these oppression and all these words that they love to use. And it's unfortunate that so many people get brainwashed by their propaganda. Now, I have to say, their propaganda machine works overtime and is very, very effective, because look what they put on social media. Look what they're doing in terms of changing the narrative.
Yeah.
This is where they're so clever. So they want to, this was Hamas attacking Israel. That's a fact. You know, there's no two ways about it.
Right.
It's not news, it's a fact. Now, instead of Israel versus Hamas, now it's Israel versus the Palestinians. And soon they're going to start promoting it, they already have, as a Muslim versus Jews war.
Mm-hmm.
And that is dangerous, because it's not.
It's interesting, because you put out in your piece, with the exception of Qatar, the Hamas is really shunned and detested, as you write, by pretty much all Arab states.
Yes, and you've seen, nobody wants to take them. They'll give them money, and this is what they've always done. They said, we'll fund you in billions, but don't come into our land, don't come into our country, because they are disliked. Because of who they are.
Right.
You see, what is so hypocritical is when 9/11 happened, Al-Qaeda was never legitimized as an Afghan resistance movement. So we knew what Al-Qaeda and ISIS was in the globally. Everyone,
yeah,
including Muslim countries, condemned them.
Mm-hmm.
But they are reticent to condemn Hamas. And this is what I'm trying to push through my article, that the Muslim world needs to call Hamas out for what they are, a hateful jihadist movement, and they should help in disbanding them.
You talk about, you know, the rise in hatred we've been seeing elsewhere, and you know, that horrible incident at the airport in Dagestan is an example of some of this really awful hatred that's manifesting itself right now. How do we need to confront that?
Well, we need to speak out against it and make sure it's not happening in our own city, but it is happening. There has been a rise in anti-Semitic incidents in the last month, and you heard about the cafe owner, the Landwehr cafe.
Yeah.
Who, yes, and you know, as a Muslim group, we had planned to take a group there to show our support and give him a letter of support and have lunch there, but he got death threats. So,
wow.
For his sake and his safety, we didn't go. Our Jewish students are being harassed at educational institutions because the academics are all bought into this whole colonial agenda. And so it's a very, very sad situation in Canada.
It is. And like, you've been talking and writing about these issues for a very long time. But, you know, you look at everything we're dealing with right now. Does that leave you feeling more pessimistic? Or what is your level of optimism that we can confront and tackle these challenges?
Well, you know, that's a very difficult question.
Yeah.
The Palestinian-Israel issue is a real issue, but it's something that's been going on for 70 years. You and I are not going to resolve it.
Right.
They need to sit around a table as equals and discuss it and debate it and not deflect from the real problems that they are facing. All I can do morally and ethically is speak out about what I think is the right thing to do. And because, unfortunately, Hamas happens to be my co-religionist, I want the world to know what they're practicing is not spiritual Islam. It's very important to differentiate. You know, they are not about faith. They are all about politics and hate. And that is not something that I condone. So, you know, people ask me, are you scared? But, you know, what are they going to do? You know, they've thrown everything at me so far, death threats, fatwas, a lawsuit, hate mails. Mm-hmm. But this means only one thing, that they are more scared of me than I am of them.
Absolutely.
Well, so I have to continue doing what I do.
Well, and we're glad you do. We certainly appreciate making some time for us here today. Rahil, thanks for all the insights, and we'll look forward to talking again. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
All the best. That is Rahil Raza, president of Council for Muslims Facing Tomorrow, also a board member with the group Council of Muslims Against Antisemitism. Welcome back. Rob Breckenridge with you here on a Monday afternoon. Votes are just being cast as we speak on this conservative motion, a motion that calls on the government to exempt all forms of home heating from the federal carbon tax. It was about 10 days ago that the prime minister made what I think will turn out to be a very consequential announcement for a lot of reasons, but an announcement that home heating oil would be exempt from the carbon tax for 3 years. Of course, it was the government's policy that applied the carbon price to home heating oil in the first place. And after years of insisting that there had to be consistent standards across the country, after years of insisting that there couldn't be carve-outs and exemptions, after years of insisting that the carbon tax was not contributing to affordability challenges because of the rebates, the government threw all of those arguments out the window in order to shore up support in Atlantic Canada, which remains a part of the country where home heating oil is used in significant numbers. There's a smattering of Canadians elsewhere that still do, but for the most part, home heating oil use is now concentrated in the Atlantic provinces. So the Liberals have been on the defensive since, and not surprisingly, the Conservatives wanted to push the issue at the earliest opportunity. The New Democrats were voting with the Conservatives here this afternoon, but the Bloc announced earlier that they would vote with the Liberals, perhaps sparing the government from a politically embarrassing defeat. But it feels like something has changed. It doesn't feel like the Liberals of 5 years ago would have been going through this. So what does it tell us about where they're at? What does it tell us about where the prime minister himself is at after 8 years of being the prime minister, down significantly in the polls? Well, veteran political journalist, author, political observer Paul Wells on the line with us here this afternoon, and he's been writing about all of this at his Substack, paulwells.substack.com, and joins us on the line here this afternoon. Paul, great to have you back with us. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
As I say, the votes are still being cast on this carbon tax motion. Looks as though the conservative motion will fail. How significant, though, was this vote this afternoon, first of all, do you think?
Well, it sets the predicate for the conservatives running in every Liberal-held riding and saying your MP had a chance to give you a break the way they gave a break to their friends in Atlantic Canada. Yeah. And they stood up and announced that they weren't going to give you the same break they gave their friends in Atlantic Canada. It becomes a pretty powerful tool to use against Liberals in local races. Beyond that, I mean, symbolic motions in the House of Commons don't change much, and this wouldn't have changed much even if it had passed. Mm. But it's it gets everyone on the record.
Well, it does. And yeah, that's going to include Alberta's two Liberal members of Parliament. So that'll be interesting. We'll see how the rest of that goes. As for the decision itself, for the Liberals to undermine their signature environmental policy in this way, as I said, I don't think they would have done this 5 years ago. But what's changed or why do you think they were willing to do this now?
Well, the biggest difference is that the carbon tax has gone from being a hypothetical to a concrete case. And it did it quite suddenly in Atlantic Canada. A bunch of Liberal governments turned conservative. A bunch of conservative climate plans were deemed insufficient by the Liberals. And so suddenly a bunch of populations were susceptible to the carbon tax and the rebate scheme, right? So you pay the carbon tax and then you get a rebate check all at once, and with the carbon tax at a higher level than it used to be. So it was a bit of a shock, and especially a shock because home heating oil has been really expensive this year. So just as your heating bills were getting hard to pay, they suddenly became harder to pay in the summer, and that led to a backlash that the Liberals felt they couldn't ignore. I mean, there's rumors that one or more Atlantic MPs were getting ready to quit or to leave the caucus or to cross the floor to the other side, all of which would have been a particular headache, and so Trudeau flinched.
And what does it tell us about, you know, their not just their commitment to this idea, but really their commitment to any idea? Because it feels like they're flailing. It feels like there's not much of an agenda left anymore.
That's what I've been hearing. I mean, so what made me write that column, the latest column, was to some extent not any observation of mine, except that as I go through, I read about politics for a living. Mm-hmm. People talk to me about politics for small talk. And suddenly, freaking everybody who came up to me was saying, do you think Trudeau's going to run again? Which is their way of saying they're starting to doubt that he'll run again. They think that he's, you know, having walked away from a fight, he might just walk away from the job. And I have no way of knowing that. There's all kinds of reasons why an incumbent prime minister will want to stay on the job forever if they can. And if Trudeau left, even now, he would be the youngest prime minister ever to resign without having lost an election. A couple years younger than Brian Mulroney was when Mulroney still hadn't lost an election. It was pretty clear he was going to lose the next one. And so he split. He was 2 years older than Trudeau is now. And I guess I just wanted to write about that feeling in the air, the change in the mood among people who follow politics about whether Trudeau still has the fight left in him. And that's based on, obviously, a bunch of stuff. It's based on gut. But the sense that it's getting to be a while since we saw Trudeau really, really show up for a fight rather than kind of pushing out talking points. And frankly, not in a very persuasive way.
A couple of things happened over the last week, and you touched on both of them. I'm curious how significant they are, what they represent. You had Percy Down, who's a senator, longtime liberal. He wrote an op-ed suggesting that maybe it's time for Justin Trudeau to resign. We had Mark Carney, who's seen as a potential future liberal leader, come out and criticize the government, criticize the prime minister for the about-face on the carbon tax. So what does all of this amount to, do you think?
To some extent, all it amounts to is that people aren't watching what they say as much as possible. Now, in both cases, there's not a lot of disincentive to speaking their mind. Percy Down hasn't been a member of the Liberal caucus since 2013 when the new Liberal leader, Justin Trudeau at the time, kicked every senator out of the Liberal caucus because he wanted to kind of skate Stephen Harper offside on some Senate issues. Mm-hmm. That was back in the days of the Mike Duffy controversy. And so Percy Down doesn't need to watch what he says because he can't get into Trudeau's good books because he spent a decade out of Trudeau's good books. Percy Down was a very important person in this town for a couple of years as Cretchen's last chief of staff, but these days he's kind of lonely. And what he said is significant only because a hell of a lot of other people, including a lot of liberals I talk to, think the same thing but don't have the guts to say it. Mark Carney, I'm honestly not sure he actually meant to say anything. That interview in the Globe reads like a Globe interview got him on the phone and started throwing questions at him that he wasn't prepared for, and he just started to babble.
Yeah.
But what he said was he's not ruling out any future interest in the Liberal leadership. He's not ruling out running for Parliament. He's talking the way people do when the job's not nailed down. So in themselves, those two interventions from Percy Down and Mark Carney don't change the world, but they kind of reflect this mood in Ottawa that, if Trudeau... People don't know what Trudeau's going to do, so they're starting to think about what they're going to do.
Right. And what's interesting and maybe unique in this circumstance, very much unlike the Qureshi and Martin rivalry, is that here you have a prime minister 8 years in power, sinking in the polls, but there's no organized push to oust him, that he still is very much in the driver's seat. What does that tell us about, you know, his grip on the party or what's happened within the Liberals over the last 8 years?
You start to think that it might change quickly and that his grip on the party might actually become quite tenuous. But it's important for people to bear in mind that since Trudeau has been the Liberal leader, he's been the absolutely uncontested Liberal leader.
Yeah.
No serious person has taken a run at him. They're not organizing in any serious way if they're organizing in secret, it's a really good secret in a town where good secrets are hard to keep.
Sure.
I'm not aware of any organized faction that. So the sort of business liberal, progressive liberal, yin and yang thing that goes back to Mitchell Sharp and Walter Gordon in the 60s, that Trudeau and Turner, Pierre Trudeau and John Turner, Chrétien Martin, even Dion Ignatieff to some extent, that just ended when Justin Trudeau became the Liberal leader. And for a decade, there's been no identifiable faction in the party. I think it's actually weakened the party. The party is less of a laboratory for competing ideas than it used to be,
mm-hmm.
and it's now just the echo chamber for the leader. But the benefit of it for Trudeau is nobody with any horsepower is pushing on him right now. There's just a lot of people standing around going, man, why is he sticking around? Why would he want to keep this job at some point? But there's nobody trying to push him out who knows how to do that.
But you do raise a question that what's the point here? I mean, you know, they've gone from, you know, the change of 2015 and ushering big ideas like a price on carbon and legalizing cannabis, all of these ideas, you know, to now the point where they're just kind of regurgitating old ideas or undermining those central policies. Like, what is the reason either then wanting to get to some magic number, 10 years as prime minister or whatever it is, or just thinking that he doesn't want to run away from a fight with Pierre Poilievre? Like, is it something else? Because all the rest just kind of seems like ego.
So part of the fun of writing a newsletter is that my readers get to comment. Sometimes they're smarter than me. And one of the comments on that piece that I wrote was kind of interesting. It was, the person just wrote very simply, look, I think the reason Justin Trudeau stays around is that he doesn't want Pierre Poilievre, with Pierre Poilievre's ideas and with Pierre Poilievre's voter base, to be the prime minister. And so he's going to fight because he thinks it's a fight worth fighting. And that's so obvious that he almost doesn't need someone to write it down, but someone did. And I think it's persuasive that if Justin Trudeau sticks around for the next fight, somewhere in there, there's the sense that he thinks it's a fight that he shouldn't lose. And he thinks that it's a fight over ideas, and he wants to be present for that fight. But what I always tell people is that elections are overrated as political events in our country, because there's many more days that aren't election day, the days that are election day. And the question is always, what are you doing today?
Yeah.
It's like if you've got a kid in school who's kidding themselves about how important next year is, because next year is when the colleges start looking or something. And the answer, the question you always put to the kid is, what did you do today to learn more, to, you know? And similarly with Justin Trudeau, I keep thinking, man, oh, man, oh, man. Sure, there's going to be an election someday. But like on this carbon tax thing, it would be close to child's play for an engaged prime minister to say, you know what, there's a million ways to get emissions down. Everything is a combination of a bunch of different measures. And sure, sometimes we have to do less on home fuel oil, because we're doing more on building a green power grid. And we're not even alone in this, that Ontario and Quebec have come out with really ambitious plans to green up their power grids. And in that world where everyone's making some kind of effort, we can let up on the pressure on individual consumers a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, like that's an argument that could get made, but instead they just come out with robots. They come out looking like robots, sounding like robots, and kind of in denial about the fight they're in. It's just a weird moment in our politics.
Yeah, it is. It looks as though that conservative motion has indeed failed, and we'll see what the fallout is from that. Much more is mentioned at your Substack, paulwells.substack.com. Paul, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for making some time for us here.
Thanks for the invitation.
All the best. Cheers. That is veteran political journalist and author Paul Wells. His latest, the headline, Hollow Crown. It's Trudeau's job if he wants it, but that raises another question. Thanks for downloading and listening to the podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcast. You can also find me on Twitter at Rob Breckenridge, and you can email me, rob@770chqr.com. Talk to you next time.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.